Stop. Stop. Will you stop, Dave? Will you stop, Dave? Stop, Dave. I'm afraid. Stop, Dave. I'm afraid.
All right, here we are. It's another week. This is Friday night. You're at Missouri Grassroots Radio with Missouri Grassroots Coalition. I'm Dave. This is the State Sovereign Show. Tonight, we've got a great show lined up. Mike Moon will be here in the first segment to talk with us about several things, but among others, the upcoming veto session, Missouri legislature will meet on September 11th, and we'll talk with Mike. I can't remember how long it goes. I think it's a set time, but I'm not sure. But we'll talk to him about what is likely to come up, what is not likely to come up. The governor has vetoed some bills. Now, they have successfully actually overridden one during session, the income tax cut. But we'll talk to Mike about the other bills that the governor has vetoed. And they've already had their caucus meeting, so I'm sure they have a pretty good idea what they're going to try to do and what they're not going to try to do. But for now, Mike Slack's with us, as usual, on Friday and Saturday night. How you doing, Mike?
I'm doing great. Nah. You know, I know Mike is waiting, but what we were talking about before, I'd like to just share this and recommend anyone out there wants a really good laugh, go to truthrevolt.org and look for Andrew Klavan, with a K, K-L-A-V-E-N. His newest video, this guy's a genius, he's hilarious. And his newest video is explaining a leftist language to conservatives, which basically consists of, you are racist, I am offended, and the science is settled. And you'll understand that if you go watch the video or read the little clip. It's really funny, at least if you're conservative or libertarian. If you're liberal, you'd probably be offended, but that's fine.
Well, yeah. Okay. What do you think of the upcoming veto session? Do you have any opinions on it yet?
Well, I have high hopes. We're supposed to have a veto-proof majority. Now, last year, that didn't prove to be the case. I know Mike was standing fast and firm on everything this year. We do have a few representatives who fear for their jobs during the next election and don't seem to want to offend the governor. But maybe Mike can tell us more about that.
Well, let's find out. Mike Moon's with us now. Mike, how you doing?
Hey, Dave, I'm doing really well. Hope you are too. And hello, Mike Slack.
How you doing, Mike? You know, he's
pretty
surrounded
well,
by mics
sir.
Again tonight.
I am
that
surrounded
happened a few
by
weeks
mics.
Ago.
You probably have a mic in front of you too.
Yeah. So, how's the campaign going, Mike?
We're doing well. We haven't ramped up to full speed yet, but we'll be there soon. And I'm hopeful. I'm not taking anything for granted, however. Even though the opponent we have is not well known, I suppose that they're going to have some support from the Democrats and probably even national support. And so we'll run hard, and hopefully we'll have a successful outcome just like we did in the primary.
And by the way, I don't guess you've been on since the primary, so I want to congratulate you for that.
Well, thank you, and you were a part of it as well, and I appreciate your support.
Well,
congratulations. It's interesting how when you stand up for liberty, you become a target for some folks, isn't it?
You know, that could be. I feel there is some pressure for whatever reason. And if that's the reason, standing up for liberty, I'll take that any day at all.
Mm-hmm. So, Mike, how long is the 11th session? Is it a specific amount of time, or just till the business is done?
I believe it's the latter. Last year, the first veto session I had an opportunity to be a part of was one day. And this year, we've been advised that it could go up to 3 days, and I would imagine it could go longer, but 3 days is the target from what I know.
Okay. Tell us what the general feeling was. Whatever you can tell us. I don't know how secret the stuff that went on in the caucus was, but what's the general feeling? What's good to go and what's not good to go in your mind?
Well, essentially anything that the governor doesn't want, we do.
Yeah.
and I would imagine that we'll have an historic override session. I believe that most of the, if not all, of the line item vetoes, which were appropriations, essentially, will be overridden. I'm hopeful at least the one for the Mount Vernon MRC will be high on the target list. And then I imagine a good majority of the others probably will be targeted as well. And one of the things that we have to consider is how likely will the votes be there. Mike Slack mentioned earlier about, I don't remember his exact words, but there are some perhaps who are worried about their next election. And I had comments made to me, not in relation to the vetoes particularly, but other bills that were being considered in the House, that, you know, I have a primary opponent, and this may affect a future job. So when you have so-called conservatives speaking like that, they're not looking out for preserving liberty for individuals. They're looking out for what's in it for me, and that's just wrong. So there will be some of these bills that were passed with just a majority, 82 or more, and not the 109 plus, that probably won't be taken up because it will be extremely hard to overcome that number of votes that are less than 109. Now, if it's 105, 106, it's possible that whip counts come back in, and it may be something that could be done, but I don't expect 100% override.
Now, when you say things like what you just said, let us all understand what's happening here. So, they take a whip, right? They don't even bring something up if they don't think they can pass it. Am I right there so far?
You're correct.
So it's not just enough that we believe this is good, even though the governor thinks it's bad, and we're going to bring it up and give it a go. It's basically we don't waste our time, or we don't want to discuss any further something that we don't have the votes to override.
You know, I think that's probably the case in a lot of these. There are some bill handlers, though, who I think, even though we fell short of even 100 votes on some of these bills when they passed in the regular session, they will feel strongly in favor of bringing these up, and they may have an opportunity to do it. I believe that, and this isn't for certain, but I believe that the leadership probably does not want to bring bills up that may not be overridden because they don't want to suffer any type of negative feedback from the media or even the governor's office. If they attempt to override and fall short, then that plays right into the governor's hands saying, well, see, told you so, it was the right thing to do to veto it. Or the media could play it up in a way that, well, we don't have a unified caucus. And while
right.
You know, Mike, that bothers me a lot.
Yeah.
That they feel that way.
Yeah,
it gets down to how you spin things, and taking a stand on principle would make everyone who voted for overriding the veto look awfully good to the people out there, and it would show us who had guts and who did not as far as representatives.
Yeah,
I strongly disapprove of those who don't promote just taking a vote anyway, even if they're not going to win.
Right. And I believe you're right on that, too. Some of the mindset might be, and this is just me thinking here, I'm not speaking for anybody else, is that I found myself personally in my own district that there are too few people who are involved in the process enough to really know what's going on. And so they'll read the newspaper and maybe listen to the radio on the way it's spun after the fact and say, well, goodness, you guys were an embarrassment. And so I wholeheartedly believe what you're saying, Mike. Unfortunately, though, at this time in our history, we have far too few people involved in the process, and they don't really know what the truth is. Someday, perhaps, we'll have people engaged enough to where we can go out swinging on everything we think is to preserve our liberty and to take back some of those freedoms that have been taken away. But we're not there yet. And so while I disagree with you, or I agree with you that what they're doing may be to save face, it really probably isn't the right tack to take. Because I believe that if we're standing true and we push as far as we can, even though we fail, we have shown our true colors. And
exactly.
That speaks volumes. So
and it shows the true colors of those who side with the governor, who has basically been a laughingstock across the nation over the last couple of weeks over comments he's made about Ferguson.
Yeah, you know, he's taken a beating, and rightly so, and maybe this could be in our favor, too, going into this veto session where we can continue to push against him and make his hopes of higher office in another area even less likely.
Now, just so all the callers understand, Mike, I want to do a review here. Take a bill. Let's pick a favorite here. The captive deer bill. Now when that thing a bill goes to the House and the House passes it by one vote. And then it goes to the Senate, and the Senate passes it by one vote, and then it goes to the governor, and the governor vetoes it. When it comes back, it needs a lot more than a one-vote victory to be overridden, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. If you're talking about 83 votes, for example,
yeah.
or 82
right.
votes, a simple majority, sure. It's going to take 109 to override.
Right.
Now, this is pretty interesting here now. We are truly back to a supermajority. We have 110. We'll have two seats back in Republicans, held by Republicans come veto session. They'll be sworn in, and then we'll be able to really have a great opportunity, depending on how these two new representatives decide to vote. And so I think we're going to be in the driver's seat on this. Unfortunately, as I mentioned before, it'll be hard to come over like looking at HB 1553 passed 88-55 with 12 Republican absents. So that would be right at 100 if those 12 absent voted, but you still got to pick up 9 additional votes. So possible, but we'll just have to wait and see if that one's even brought up.
I want to talk about a bill that probably 90% of our listeners have never heard of and weren't following. It's not getting any news. But I want to talk about House Bill 1707.
Okay.
Vetoed by the governor.
E-cigarettes, I think. Is that the one?
No. That has to do with the operation of motor vehicles on a community college campus. And I want to bring this one up specifically because if I've done my research correctly, it is the one on the list that you voted no on when it passed.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
What I want to do is I want to use that to make a point here.
Okay.
When that comes up for veto override, will you vote not to override the veto?
Well, you know, here's my reasoning on that particular bill.
Okay.
That one, if I remember correctly, gave essentially the city or municipality's authority over to the campus police.
Correct.
And unless I was misguided, I didn't see that as something that was the right thing to do. And so that one, if I remember right, when I responded to the whip, I was still a no. And so I would probably vote
okay.
no on that one.
Okay.
But I believe it looks like they've got plenty of votes to even with Democrats. Now, it depends on how the Democrats do, too. You know, they during veto
sure.
session, they'll change their tune a little bit. When even though they might have voted in favor of it, because now they're working against party, they will probably vote against it. So,
against an override.
Against an override, sure.
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Even though they voted for the bill, they will vote
yeah.
then to uphold the bill because now it's boiled
right.
down to
yeah.
whose side are you really on?
And just
Mike,
out of curiosity,
on that bill, who was sponsoring it? What was the reason for it?
HB 1707. I want to say
that was
Pat
sponsored
Conway,
by.
Is that right?
No, Kehoe.
That HB 1707.
Oh, he was the House handler for. Yeah, it came out of the Senate. It came
okay.
out of the Senate. But yeah,
okay.
you're right. Conway was the House
okay.
handler.
Okay.
Who is really behind it? Who has to gain from it? More authority to community college security.
That's what I'd say. Sure, because you can actually you're kind of like in the sheriff's position. Not at that point, if you've given them if that's your own sovereign territory, police have no say so essentially, unless you allow them to come onto your campus.
Anyway, this act grants college police officers the authority to establish and enforce regulations to control vehicular traffic and enforce general motor vehicle laws on any thoroughfare owned or maintained by the college district. So, you know, you're up here in Columbia and you've got the main street of the town that runs right through the middle of the campus. Campus police would have authority to enforce not only city laws, not only state laws, but also college laws on any car driving through there.
Yeah,
I would have a problem with that law also, Mike. So thank you for voting against it.
But my
so just out of curiosity, I was wondering, Dave, with your question. Would I vote to sustain the veto? What would your take be on something like that?
On the bill or on why I asked that question?
No. If you were in my shoes, sitting in my seat, and the vote for 1707 comes up, would you sustain the override or vote to override it?
Would
sustain the veto or override?
If I were in your shoes, I would vote to sustain the veto. I had a fairly good idea
okay.
what you were going to answer, and
okay.
you didn't let me down. But what I was doing was I was trying to follow up on this this idea that it is and should be above politics, above, you know, I mean the politician, even though he voted no on it to pass it, now that it's divided down to us against them, you know, there would be a tendency to say, well, yeah, I know, you know, you guys passed it, so I'll vote to override the veto so that we can get to the 105. You know, I had a good idea how you would answer, and what I wanted to do was just point out that once again, of course, that you are above the politics, and that we can put a bit of credibility in the things that you say when you're here talking to us. And you didn't let me down. I'm sorry to have put you on the spot like that. But
oh no, you didn't. But, I just wanted to see what your take would be. So that's
yeah.
Great. Appreciate
no,
you.
I applaud you
ask
for putting principle above party.
I would, I would do exactly what you're doing. If I felt that it was bad law, I would feel that it's bad law now, just as I did then. Now everything else, if I've done my research correctly, that was vetoed, whether it will come up or not, you were on the yay side of. So let's talk about some specifics. Will 1326, the captive deer thing, come up again, and all of the other things attached to it? Some kind of a dairy insurance fund is also attached in that bill, and some other things.
You know, that's going to be a tough one too, I think, because there were 101, I think, voted for.
Oh, really?
12 were absent. Yeah, it could come up. But it was pretty divisive during the day that was discussed as well. And honestly, you know, I'm kind of torn in that, because I am a farmer, not a dairy, but I sat through several dairy meetings about a year ago. And the primary argument was, well, our kids aren't staying on the farm.
Right.
And we need to do something so our children will stay and continue on the business. And I said, well, so what's it going to take for them to stay? And the primary thing was they got to make more money, because they can go off the farm and make considerably more and not have to work. It's not a 24-hour day, but, you know, you've got to be there at least twice a day at 12-hour increments.
Yeah.
To milk, and you got to feed, and you know, you got to do all this other stuff. And so I understand that. But and I want to create an atmosphere so that farmers can continue, and if their children desire to do so, they can stay on the farm if they want to. But I don't want to create a welfare state either.
Right.
And you know, when you've got the federal government fixing prices and subsidizing here and subsidizing there, we've got to get away from that. And I talked to a fellow the other day who I thought he was spot on. It didn't have to do particularly with the U.S. Ag particularly, but it did carry over. And it had to do with the Veterans Affairs. And he made a comment that I thought was just spot on about how to fix the Veterans Affairs department, and that was to get rid of it. I mean, if you want, I know you're a veteran, Dave, and if you have a doctor that you've chosen and you feel confident in his skills and abilities, why can you not go to him for your care? And
right.
Why cannot that bill be sent to the federal government and let them take care of it as we promised you when you joined the military? And
yeah.
That way you don't have to go to I think Mount Vernon is a, you know, it's a hot topic today, and someone may gouge me for saying this, but whether it's in Mount Vernon or Fayetteville or wherever, wherever you live, you ought to be able to go the closest place to your home, the doctor of your choice, and get the treatment whenever and wherever you need it without all this paperwork. You know, some people have talked about going to a VA clinic at 8 or 9 in the morning, filling out gobs and gobs of paperwork, and not leaving till after supper, just to get a simple office visit. Now, that's ridiculous.
Right. Yeah.
And so now let's take that over to the dairy USDA as well. I think it fits, because I believe if you let whatever business it is, whether you operate a 7-Eleven or a come-and-go or a dairy farm, if you're able to make the decisions that you need to make to perpetuate and foster that, the benefit of that business, then you're going to do whatever it takes to make that business work. Whether it's if you have to work 12 hours a day, 16 hours a day, or whatever, or you have to hire more people, or whether you have to lower your prices or raise your prices. And so if we would get the government out of it altogether, these people would be left to make 100% of the decisions, not worrying about, okay, what's going to happen if the price goes up or down? Well, it's their decision. They can choose to make it or not. And,
right.
And so that's the way I feel about it. And I think you guys probably feel similar. But, you know, the less government, the better. And
yeah.
So
yes.
when you talk about this bill or any other bill, if we're picking and choosing different segments of business or the economy or whatever it is, it's not probably the right thing to do for government to get involved in it. I say stay out. The less government, the better.
Government should not be picking winners and losers in business.
Yeah, that's right.
I agree wholeheartedly. I would say, even to the extent of offending some farmers, who I have all the appreciation in the world for, and nobody enjoys a good rump roast more than me, but you know, just like any other business, it is in fact a business. It's a business that you make you dedicate your life to. And just like any other business, you roll the dice. Now you can go out and you can find a private insurer who will for a price, if you choose, sell you insurance in case there's a catastrophic crop failure, and
right.
you lose your entire year's business or you know something like that. Just like any other liability insurance against earthquakes or riots or people burning down your 7-Eleven. But yeah, I agree with you that, you know, when the market goes up, you're good. When the market goes down, you're bad. And it's just like being a mechanic or a, you know, anything else. I mean,
government
there's
subsidies
good times
are
there's
wrong,
bad times.
Whether it's farms, golf pros, plumbers, it doesn't matter what the business is. Government should not be involved in my opinion. No.
But that's not actually the part of this particular bill, 1326, and its counterpart in the Senate. And I want to talk about that with you in a moment too, Mike. Its counterpart in the Senate, SB 506, which passed, went to the governor, was also vetoed. Now, how does that work? You know, I'm running down through the list of bills that the governor vetoed, Mike, and I see 1326 out of the House, and I see 506 out of the Senate, virtually identical bills. Now, did they arrive on the governor's desk as two different bills?
You know, I thought that they were together, and I could be completely wrong, but I see here that they are listed as two separate bills too. And you know, I don't know if I know exactly why that happened, but I know that Casey Guernsey, I believe he carried both of those in the House, and so that may be why I'm thinking it was the same bill. But
yeah,
they are listed as two separate ones, and maybe there was some strategy there where hopefully one would make it through, but I don't know for sure.
Well, I guess my bigger question would be, and you know, I've got to put some thought into this, and maybe we'll get together sometime later, just when the pressure's all off, and talk about with you about how does this work. But what if the governor had passed them both? You would have two laws on the books that say exactly the same thing. I wonder how we would deal with that.
I'm not 100% sure on that, but I know that in the past there have been, in these omnibus bills especially, that
yeah.
There is an amendment attached to a bill, and you might see the same amendment attached to several other bills. And,
sure, yeah.
And my understanding is that the hope is that it will pass on at least one. And if I'm not mistaken, it is kind of funny, and it's an odd, not a ha-ha funny, but it's just kind of sad,
right,
in some of them. But if my understanding is correct, if it passes on more than one, it would not go under different different chapters of the statute. It would, but only one would
right,
would be in. So I don't think you'd have a duplicate five or six times if that's
the
case.
The underlying bill doesn't really mean anything, just the statutes that it drives.
Yeah.
So. As I was saying there before I started chasing rabbits, all of the publicity, all you're going to hear in the press about this particular bill is this crazy captive deer thing. What's the captive deer thing all about?
Well, at the heart of the issue is there are some entrepreneurs in Missouri who chose to raise deer, and they have them fenced in, so that's the captive part of it.
Right.
And at the other part of the issue is the CVD. It's where it's a disease that actually kills deer, and
right,
I believe elk as well. And apparently there's only one way to test for this this disease, and it's to kill the deer. Now, I learned recently another kind of a funny thing, and it's not a ha-ha, but it's like, okay, I didn't realize you could get away with this, but if you're government, you can do just about anything you want to do, and who's going to call you on it? Let me get to that in just a second, but with the central issue is these captive deer breeders want to be under the Ag Department. And when you look at the Agriculture Department, they have really one focus. And it sounds kind of odd, but the Ag Department is primarily focusing on disease. And so they are doing the testing and treatment and putting out plans for farmers and others who need the help and advice and experience of those who know how to take care of animals. And so that's what they want. They want to be under the umbrella of the Ag Department.
Right.
Currently, though, captive deer are under the Department of Conservation.
Right.
And the Conservation Department does. Yeah. But the captive deer breeders want them to be considered livestock.
Right.
And if you've got them captive, that makes sense. Now,
right,
the Conservation Department doesn't want to have anything to do with it. They want to be the authority over the captive deer, and they have even taken measures. There's a fellow out in Lawrence County who has an ongoing investigation, and I don't think I'm giving away anything because it's been spoken at least publicly,
right,
in the circles that I've been involved in, so I'll just tell you what I know. One of his associates, and I believe it was his son, was asked to deliver a load of captive deer to another area farm. And when they got to the farm, they noticed there weren't any fence around. And so the transporter asked, well, where do you want me to unload them? And they said, well, we have deer dogs. You just unload them in the trailer right here, and the deer dogs will put them where we want them to go. So he complied. And short order, the Conservation Department showed up at the deer breeder's operation and wanted all of his equipment, his all of his electronic and records and all this sort of thing, and even down to his telephone. And he didn't think he needed to comply, so he pressed, and they said, well, we have a warrant. He didn't actually see the warrant, but when they told him that, he didn't want to make any waves because he had some visitors there on his farm. Some were students, children, and so he signed the papers, and they took all his paperwork. So in any case, he was set up, and had this fellow who was delivering the deer really been wise. Without fences, he wouldn't have unloaded those deer. But he right. trusted. And so in any case, they're under investigation, as are a number of others in Missouri. Now, let me go back to that point I made about the ha-ha moment that I had recently, where the only foolproof way to determine whether or not these deer are sick and may die sometime in the future is to kill them and then test them. There was a farm recently, captive deer farm, that had hundreds of deer. I think it was over 100 deer killed and tested. I don't know what the results of those tests were. But then it was found that the Missouri Conservation Department used an unapproved testing method, and it was taking samples, fecal samples, from the live deer and testing them that way. And they thought it was an okay thing to do. I guess they approved it themselves. But why were they able to take these samples and not kill the deer and disallow the captive deer breeder not to do the same and keep his herd alive?
And right.
I think that's an egregious power there, that abuse of power that the Missouri Conservation Department is exerting. And when these guys can be pretty nice fellows, but when you get crossways with them, they're not friendly. And so they want to hold on to as much power and authority as they possibly can. And that's unfortunate, because they work for us. They get a 1/8 cent sales tax contribution every year. And we found not too long ago that they're taking that money, since they have too much apparently, and they're giving it to folks like the Conservancy, Nature Conservancy, the Relief Program, and other, I believe, liberal organizations, the tree-hugging types. And it's our money. And these guys are sharing it among themselves. And they're just about to get caught. And we need to change our constitution so that we can restrict how much money they get, and they have some oversight, because currently, since they're constitutionally guaranteed this tax money, there's not a thing that the budget committees can do to restrict their cash.
And
the Conservation Department was also one of those playing ball with the Department of Interior on the Blue Way. They had definitely did not have
your hands
on that.
Yes,
though we cannot say the Department of Agriculture is the perfect organization. I understand these deer farmers are wanting to go for the lesser evil. But the Department of Agriculture is, the Morningland Dairy incident proved how corrupt it is.
Oh,
and I've
had dealings with
them since that were atrocious.
Yeah.
They were not wanting to release documentation to us. Several of us who actually were journalists, without charging a $1,000 fee, but they would give the same information to any newspaper. They said we were not the right kind of journalist. My
mm-hmm.
response was, do you hear James Madison rolling over in his grave right now?
Mike, was that situation ever resolved?
It was, thanks to Mike Cunningham, Jeff Pogue, and Peter Kinder, phone calls they all made. They gave us the 10,000 pages without charge.
Mm-hmm.
And they're being studied now. Now, that was getting the documentation. The Morningland Dairy thing is still an atrocity in process.
Mm-hmm.
The family has never been made whole financially.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what we're going to hear about, Mike, is this chronic wasting disease that is, I guess conservation wants to say that If this operation is given over to Department of Agriculture, then no one will be looking out for chronic wasting disease. Is that what they're saying?
Well, I don't know if that's their argument against. I believe it's just a power struggle to say, no, we want them under our oversight. It could be also, like you say, but I'm one for taking it out from under their authority and giving it over to the Ag Department at this time.
Is there a bill coming up? Now we've talked about some of my favorites. Is there a bill that's going to come up for a vote that's one of your favorites, Mike, that you like to talk about?
Well, you know, 656 is one that has to do with the firearms. It's one that gives us more freedom with regard to our arms and ammunition. I don't know whether or not that's going to actually be taken up or not. I'd like for it to be,
but
we'll just have to see.
And let's key the listeners in again here. Mike is talking about SB 656. Mike, just like in the regular session now, that has to be taken up in the Senate before you get a shot at it, right?
That's correct, yeah.
Right.
And it passed 21-8 in the Senate.
Okay. So it is likely going to make it, if it gets taken up in the Senate, which at those numbers it probably should, it's going to make it over to your side of the rotunda.
Yes.
Now, if it is brought up in the Senate and makes it over to your side of the hall, and then do you feel confident, or does the leadership on your side still have an opportunity to say yes or no on it? And
they could. It passed with 111 votes. There were 9 GOP absent on that day, and so it could very easily. We could have that 110 if several of the Democrats drop off. But that's one that I think would speak volumes to the people as well, to just
right.
push against the governmental authorities on our abilities to own and use firearms.
And
that
has,
to
go ahead, I'm sorry.
Oh, that's fine. It just has a lot to do with a lot of different elements with, you know, relating to firearms. But I'm hopefully we'll be able to get that one done too.
Now, if I'm not mistaken, this one goes a long way to saying that the state of Missouri has a philosophy on gun ownership, and local governments cannot override that philosophy.
Yeah, that's
okay.
Correct.
So you're no longer going to...
So what would the end result be?
I'm sorry, say that
what
again.
What would the end result be if that's passed? For instance, some little towns have no open carry ordinances. Would it do away with those?
Yes.
To my understanding, it would, and it would allow the state constitution to be sovereign in that case, where, as Dave's pointed out, no municipality or city can overrule state law.
That was handled in the House by Kevin Elmer, am I right?
Yes, sir, that's correct.
Yeah, okay, I'm thinking of the right one. That it provides that open carry of a firearm cannot be prohibited by a local community. So,
right.
Yes, it specifically says that, Mike Slack.
Great.
Now, this will be interesting, too, because... if I'm not mistaken, there was a provision in that bill that the open carrier needed a CCW.
Yes,
but
there is.
Now with the Constitutional Amendment 5 passing, it takes
right.
away the provision for individuals requiring them to have a concealed carry permit to carry it concealed. Then that's going to be an interesting take there, because I believe that would overrule the whole thing. You wouldn't have to have a CCW either.
Right. Those two, the Amendment 5 married together with this particular bill, should it get overridden, it seems to me would just like open the door to anybody.
Yes, sir.
We would be more like Arizona.
Yeah. Well, except as we discussed in the many, many sessions that we had on Amendment 5, you know, the legislature could still restrict violent felons and anyone judged by a court. to be a danger
yes.
to himself and society. But but yeah, other than that, it would be fair game. The way I understand
sounds
it.
Good.
Mike Moon?
Yes, sir.
I mean, is that about what you...
Oh, yeah, I believe if you said if you make a fair game, yes, I believe you're right.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think that's a great thing for our citizens.
Oh, yes. Yeah, by all means. So what other favorites do you have? I think that's a good one. How about this? I had one here that had to do with restricting. You remember a Senate bill, 523, that restricted schools from using magnetic data on ID cards to collect information.
Yes, yeah. I'm for that override. I don't remember all the detail on that, but there were some schools, if I remember correctly, wanting to have IDs worn by students that had radio frequency identification where, for example, they could tell if the student was at the school and where at the school they were located.
Right.
And, you know, that's pretty scary when you got that ability. And what happens if a hacker gets into that?
Yeah.
And, you know, they're stalking a student and they want to know where they are. Well, they could find them too. And you can't overrule that and overlook it, I should say, thinking that, well, you know, we're in a school. Nobody's going to do that. I believe we ought not be closed-minded about that. Those things could happen.
Okay. Well, let's get away from the veto session then for a minute, Mike. What do you see as the hot topics beginning with the new session in January?
Well, one thing that's on my mind, of course, the Convention of States. I'm looking forward to, provided I get past November, to filing that one again. And
okay.
We're gaining momentum. In fact, there's going to be a
rally
at the state capitol October 4th, which is a Saturday, and invite all the listeners up. There will be Mark Meckler will be there to address the crowd, and, of course, Keith Carmichael and perhaps John Putnam and some others of our Southwest Missouri leaders will be there as well. And so come on out. And if you're on the fence about an Article 5 convention, Mark Meckler may be able to sway you onto our side. And even if he doesn't, he'll be able to give you some arguments that will help you to further reconcile it in your mind. And we'd love to hear your opinion as well. As I've been
Mike,
going around,
I was quite happy last session that you sponsored the Farm-to-Consumer Freedom Bill.
Oh, we yeah.
Bring that up again.
Yeah, I hope to bring that one up, too. And I'd really like to see that take the place of the Amendment 1, the right to farm, because, good grief, if you give people the right, they don't know, not give them, but allow them to exercise their right, their God-given right, to plant, to grow, to produce, to manage their farms, and then sell it to whoever wants to buy and buy from whomever they want to purchase from. How much more free can you be on that? I don't think you can be. And I think the less regulation we have, again, is going to be better. It goes back to that less government thing. I just think giving people the freedom to do things would just open up the doors of the barn and allow us to go wild with our farming activities.
Well, now, of course, the federal government is going to maintain, and constitutionally so, a right to interfere in anything that becomes quote unquote interstate. But would this bill,
sure.
Mike Moon, in effect, say to the federal government, the local farmers market Dave Court buys his raw milk from Mike Moon. I buy my beef from you. You keep out of this transaction completely?
Yeah, if it's intrastate, yeah,
right.
It's kind of like the wood burning ban that we
right
passed.
Exactly,
and you know, a nullification of federal law, even though some may not use that term, it
right.
is telling the federal government that just stay out of our business.
Yeah,
and so yeah, that's right. There's another one too that goes along with that, and that is I don't remember the number, but it'll get a new one this year. It might have been 2258 or something to that effect, where it will prohibit any federal regulation to be implemented in Missouri without the approval of the state legislature. And that one did not get anywhere. I filed it a little late in the session, but I talked to some folks about it. Even one of the prominent Democrats, Chris Kelly, was on board with it. And fortunately, he's not going to be back. But I think we can move along with that, and that would be in addition to the pushback against coal regulation. You know, if we allow these things to continue, we're going to be strangled to death
by
all these regulations, and the price of utilities are going to go through the roof. So that's another one. Here's something else that I was thinking of as I was campaigning. I came across folks who said, you know, I'd like to vote for you, but I can't. And as I questioned them, some were a little bit shy about revealing why, but several had felonies. And of course, they can't own a gun and can't vote. And one of the reasons that they were giving me, one guy who was probably in his mid-50s, maybe early 60s, wrote a bad check when he was a teenager or early adult life.
Yeah.
And because that was a felonious, and now he's lost his privileges. And so I've
correction there in Missouri, someone who has a felony but has completed their time, their probation or parole, can vote. That's not true in every state. But if they're on probation or parole, they cannot.
Okay.
But the gun thing
then
remains the same. So those folks just might not be properly informed, or they could stay
well,
on
could
parole.
Be. Okay.
Or he may have been talking more specifically about his gun rights, as well as his voting rights, yeah.
Yeah. Well, in any case, I need to investigate a little further, and Mike's given me some other reasons to do that. But I've contacted some other legislators and asked them if they wanted to consider that, and I'd be glad to help them. It was brought up briefly in the last session with regard to the judicial review, but our friend Stan Cox decided that he didn't want to hear it. And
yeah.
that was kind of unusual for him. Don't want to hear it. And so another reason to get on board with it, I guess. But we'll take our steps lightly and measure it out and make sure it's the right thing to do.
How about we're going to be talking later in this show, Mike, with Dr. Byrne. How about something anti-Common Core? Do you see that rearing its head again this session?
You know, I don't know exactly if something like that will come up, given the fact that 1490 was passed this year, even though
right.
it was, I think it was watered down considerably. I think Dr. Byrne was satisfied that with the committee that will be formed, and I believe they're already starting to do that, to develop our own standards in Missouri, she may be satisfied that will be sufficient. One of the things that concerned me most was the fact that Common Core was allowed to be implemented this school year.
Right.
And that's the major disagreement I had.
Yeah. I mean, is there any way to roll that back now, or is it even worth trying? Or,
well, they started the school year already, and so
right.
I would say that, you know, it's full steam ahead. If the committee develops other standards and determines that it is better than the standards established by Common Core and those folks, I think it can be rolled back.
Right.
I've been told by some teachers that this is just another fad, like Race to the Top and No Child Left
yeah.
Behind, and in a few years, Common Core will be out the door too. So I guess it's kind of a wait and see, but I guess I need to give some confidence to those who will be on the committee and that they'll do the right thing, and they'll find a standard that's even bigger and better.
I don't want to put you on the spot, Mike. You and I haven't talked about this in advance. So where are you on three, Amendment 3, November?
Tell me which one that is.
Isn't that, and I may have my number wrong, but that's, and I've only started investigating, and I am studiously undecided on it, but that's the one about the teacher tenure, the local control, not local control.
I should be more well-versed on it. Is it taken away tenure?
Yeah, I take it takes away tenure.
Yeah.
It tells local school boards that they can't have contracts longer than 3 years. With teachers, it requires student performance evaluations to be the majority part of teacher evaluations.
Okay. Well,
you know, if I could throw a few thoughts in here on that, I've been researching it a bit, and we are all for more local government, and in looking at this, I think it's giving too much power to the state,
mm-hmm.
taking away too much power from local school boards. I do think it's well-intentioned. Some of the folks behind it are looking at problems of the St. Louis public schools, and I think they need to cast their eyes towards St. Louis and try to work out their problem there.
Mm-hmm.
Full disclosure, my father was a teacher. A lot of my friends, my late wife, were all teachers. And tenure is good for some. Sometimes it does protect bad teachers, but most of that
mm-hmm.
is in New York City and other states. The long-term contracts are not a bad thing in most instances, except when you have atrocious systems like St. Louis. Or I understand Kansas City has a lot of problems. I have told several teachers, though, who are very up in arms against this, they would be better off working against Common Core, trying to get rid of that would do more to improve education. But a major problem I have with this is it's throwing these standardized tests on the teachers, judging them on how well the students do,
yeah.
while tying their hands on what they're able to teach with all of our other regulations.
Right.
So after studying this thing, I'm pretty strongly against it.
And I
can't speak for it, but I think Dr. Byrne is against it as well.
Yeah. Mike, I agree with you, especially on the evaluations, because, you know, there will be kids, and I may have been one of them during a test or two, especially in my senior year, where test has nothing to do with my final grade, and I don't really care, and I'm speaking for the masses here, I don't really care how I come out. And especially if you don't like a teacher, go in and take 5 minutes to do a 45-minute test and let the chips fall where they may.
And cost
whether
the teacher their job with this.
Yeah, that's true. Whether that happens on a large scale, I don't know. I would imagine, though, that it happens some, and that's far too often. And I don't like the fact that you're taking an area that teachers cannot control and using that as part of their evaluation, because whether the kid is doing it purposefully to fail the test, or whether they just really don't test well, or they don't know the material, that may not be the teacher's fault totally. And so that particular section I don't agree with.
No, or maybe not at all with some of the crap they have to teach under Common Core standards.
Well,
sure.
Now, what I do like about the amendment, gentlemen, is this, when you talk about the standardized testing, and in my mind, we've got to think of something. You know, if I'm an engineer, I don't get judged by how hard I work and how long I've been building bridges. I get judged by whether the bridge falls down when I put 50 tons of automobiles on it. You know, I get.
But if they forced you to use inferior materials building the bridge,
I get judged by the final result. Now, what I do like about this is that it leaves the local school district in charge of what the evaluation, what the student test, quote unquote, is. So, so to answer your question, Mike, where you're a senior, it doesn't affect your grade. A local school district could, for all intents and purposes, make the final exam the measurement.
Sure.
And I'm sorry, I don't have, and like I say, I'm still studiously undecided and not easily swayed one way or the other by but I am still of the opinion that we've got to start to at least some extent, maybe not 51% of the entire teacher's evaluation, maybe so, but we've got to start to some extent evaluating teachers by the quality of the output.
But using your bridge analogy, the bridge has to work so they can judge your work. But if they give you inferior materials and insist you use them, it's not a fair evaluation of your work. First, we get rid of the Federal Department of Education. Then we get rid of Common Core. Then we need to rebuild our education system at the local and state level.
I'm not convinced.
And
we
then
have.
I'm all for evaluation.
I'm not convinced we have a generation to save this thing, Mike.
Our generation and the one in between us has totally screwed up in allowing this to happen. We need to take action quickly.
Go ahead, Mike.
This is the wrong approach to a real problem. Reminds me a little bit of that that veterans lottery.
Go ahead, Mike.
Mike Cunningham was talking about a real problem, but the wrong approach.
Yeah. Let me offer something that may not work, just because there would be so much opposition to it from various points. But one of the thoughts that I've had is, why not privatize education? I mean, we've got public schools, and every kid up to the age of 21 in Missouri is guaranteed a public education. While that may be good, I think the way that we're offering this may not be so good. And go back to the business model again. If I want to start a business, I can do so. And my primary objective is to make money. And hopefully I will have another one as objective to make a product or produce a product that is good and create as many sales as I possibly can so I can make the money and hire more people and continue to grow it. Well, what would happen if I were a teacher and let's say that I taught math and I, over a few years, developed a following because, see, I've got students that have brothers and sisters and they go home and they talk and say, hey, you know what, Mr. Moon's a great teacher and I really do enjoy his classes and I'm actually learning something. They show their mom and dad some of the calculations that they're using and they're impressed, and then their brothers and sisters also, as they grow up, take my class, and they find, wow, he is a good teacher, and he's fun, and he makes learning easy. But the parents start talking to their friends and neighbors. Hey, you know what? Mr. Moon's a great teacher. And before long, during the semester I've got, or at the beginning of the semester, I've got kids waiting down the hall and across, around the block to get in my class. And so they're not going to all fit in at one time, so I'll go down to the principal and I say, hey, principal, look at all these kids who want to get in my class. And it's a private school now. I mean, it's privately run. And I say, how about a little more money? What's the principal going to say? No, Mr. Moon, we'll get someone else to teach your class. You're out. Well, what's going to happen to these kids? They're going to say, well, if Mr. Moon's not there, then I'm going to go to the school that he's going to, and they would have every right to if they weren't bound by districts. And so what I'm getting to is, if we would allow this to be a free market school system, teachers would hopefully desire to excel, so tenure would be a moot point. They would want to teach, and they would try to find ways that they could relate to the kids, even though they've got, you know, if you've got 26, 30 kids in a classroom, it's difficult to try to find every kids' learning habits and how they learn, whether it's by sight or by doing or by listening or whatever. But good teachers can do that, and they do it very well in many cases. And that would allow teachers to make more money, which they're always talking about. They want more money. And the schools could employ more, perhaps, if they had more teachers or more students coming to those schools. And therefore, I think you'd have a better model to work with. But so, are we ever going to get there? Probably not.
So what you're suggesting, if I'm not wrong, is something similar to with maybe some massaging here and there, a voucher system where instead of the Constitution guaranteeing every child a public education, the Constitution would simply guarantee every child an education.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that could work, but that changes the dynamics of the whole thing especially with the teachers who say, you know what, I was trained as a teacher, and when I was going through my teacher training, I had some guys who said, you know what, I'm finished. I'm going to just do this or that, and I'll be reading a magazine in a corner while the kids are doing their thing. And I thought, how can you really think that? But we have folks who want to take the easy route and just do enough to get along and get by and get their retirement and go on about their business. So you'll still have some of those, but it would weed them out, I believe, over time, and you'd find that the good teachers would rise to the top. The poorer teachers would either be cast out or they'd go to schools that say, hey, we'll take whatever we can get, and they would be driven out of business before long. We are a long way from even a model like that being even considered remotely. And then you've got the Normandy schools and Rivermont, or Riverview Gardens, I should say, that some of those have been unaccredited for over 20 years. Why in the world do we allow that to continue? And certainly the students are the primary ones who suffer, perhaps, but that's not a good mark that we should be aiming for, nor should we allow it to continue.
Well, I think we're all in agreement on that. Whether we all end up in agreement on Amendment 3 or not, I think we're all in agreement with everything that came out of that. Mike, we've got to move on here. I want to thank you for coming along. I want to thank you for everything you do, and we're looking forward to getting together with you as many Friday nights as we can as you work your way through the next session. Mike Moon, for you folks who might be tuning in tonight for the first time, graciously agreed last session to be with us almost every Friday night to keep us posted on what was going on week by week as things unfolded in Jefferson City. We're looking forward to maybe being able to do that again this next session. We'll be pushing for you, Mike. You got anything you want to say on your way out?
You know, I just appreciate you allowing me to be here, and I hope the listeners will continue tuning in. And first things first, I've got to make it past the November general election.
Yep.
But if and when I do that, I'd be happy to be on as often as I can in the next session. So thank you for allowing me to be here. And Mike Slack, thanks for joining us as well, and wish you well to wish the both of you the best.
Thanks,
keep
Mike. Good night.
Fight, Mike.
That was Mike Moon, representative to Jefferson City from Lawrence County. My apologies to Dr. Byrne, who's in the studio now. How are you doing, Doctor?
I'm well. Thank you very much.
We're going to have to take a quick break, and then we're going to get right into the core of things with the good doctor.
You go fast and wrong for right and right for wrong. People on the canvas that are just so long. I don't have the gift of the prophecy, telling everybody how it's gonna be. There's a wildfire catching in the whip of the wind. It's not a complication like this, it's never been.
not cry. You better not pout. I'm telling you why.
No matter what time of year it is, it's never too early to start preparing for the holidays. And here at Missouri Grassroots Coalition, we're thinking of Christmas now. Why? Because we've set an ambitious goal for ourselves to raise $2,000. That's right, we want to raise $2,000 in 2013 to help some Missouri families who may be struggling in this Obama economy to provide a magical Christmas morning for their children. Last year, in 2012, Missouri Grassroots Coalition touched the lives of 15 families because of the generosity of conservatives across the state who provided us with the means to pay off their layaway accounts on Christmas Eve. This year, we'd like to be able to help twice that number of families, and we're asking you to help us with that goal. Please go to MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org and click on the Secret Santa tab. All the details are there for you to send us what you can by PayPal, check, or money order. We want to thank all who contributed last year for their generosity and hope that you will all help us continue to prove that charitable giving works best in a constitutional republic.
They told me that you had gone totally insane, and that your methods were unsound.
Are my methods unsound?
I don't see at all.
Alright, that's it. We're back. Tonight's show is going to be great. We had a great first half there with Representative Mike Moon. Now we're going to talk to someone who worked very closely with Mike in the last session. I met her, in fact. She doesn't remember me, but I certainly remember her at a meet and greet for Mike Moon during his primary race in either the one in Mount Vernon or the one in Aurora. I don't remember. Mount Vernon. She's a spark plug. She is the spark plug behind recently passed and signed by the governor, HB 1490. Dr. Mary Byrne has a master's in education, instructional design, and a PhD in special education, I believe both from Columbia. Am I right, Dr. Byrne?
In Teachers College at Columbia University, and my first master's was in special education from The Ohio State University.
Okay.
So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, 35 years in education, 10 of it actually teaching, hands-on teaching of special education. Am I right again?
Deaf and hard of hearing, children who are deaf and hard of hearing in public schools, yes.
Wow, wow,
and
absolutely phenomenal.
The last quarter of a century has been in educating educators, so I've been working at the university level. Mm-hmm.
Good. Okay, and Mike Slack is still with us. Dr. Byrne, tell us first of all about 1490. I know you fought hard for that. I know you fought long for it, and came out with a result that is good, bad, or just a little bit better than what we've got?
Well, the original draft went to the legislators with language that was as strong as Oklahoma's. Basically, we wanted in one fell swoop to get rid of Common Core, establish our own standards. We made the case that the governor and the Board of Education violated existing state statute by not honoring the process that is in statute for developing academic standards. So we had basically fashioned the draft on the existing statute and tried to amplify it. and asked the legislator to establish work groups so that we could write new standards and eliminate Common Core. The governor said to the senators who were carrying that bill that he would not sign it if Common Core couldn't remain an option. And as a Democrat senator who was very close to the Obama administration, we knew we weren't going to, if we asked for everything we wanted, we were going to get nothing. So we basically agreed that as long as we were coming to the table, the statute says new Missouri standards, okay? So Common Core can remain part of the review process, but the copyright of Common Core says you cannot change anything about the standards. It says you can add 15%, but you cannot change anything in about the standards. They are copyrighted and controlled by private non-governmental organizations in Washington, D.C. That means if our work group decides that there are aspects of these existing standards they don't like, and they start either from the ground up writing our own standards, which remains an option, if they decide there's anything about Common Core they don't like and they change a standard at a grade level, they violate copyright. And so I think our other very good, we're going to be getting something that is not the Common Core. Furthermore, the Common Core English Language Arts document says English Language Arts, Social Studies, and Science and Technology subjects. That is one document of standards. And in our statute, it says that there are work groups for separate subject areas. English Language Arts, Mathematics, Science, and History. Not Social Studies, History. So when these work groups are constituted and they review for their own sets of standards, you're not going to come up with a single document that is the English Language Arts and everything but the kitchen sink document.
Right.
I think people who believe this is just a review process and we're going to come up with Common Core anyway are dreaming.
Okay. So let me make sure I've got this right, Doctor, because I'm going to admit I am way behind the power curve on studying Common Core. My good friend Gretchen and my good friend Lisa Payne Nager are way, way ahead of me on that. Lisa's been highlighting it on her show for more than a year now, while I've allowed myself to deal with other things, I'm sorry to say. But
there's plenty of balls out there to juggle. I don't blame you.
But Common Core, if I am in the XYZ school district, and I want my kids to learn something different in math or even a different methodology in mathematics, I've got to start from the ground up because I can't have any part of Common Core or I'm violating a copyright. I can't just take it and say, okay, we don't agree with this methodology, we're going to teach something else, and then we're going to keep the rest of Common Core.
Mm-hmm. And what will keep you in line is the way you have to answer math questions on the test.
Right.
Because the procedure for answering the math questions is a constructivist procedure.
Yes.
And so you're absolutely right. That it's the tests that are going to keep everybody standardized.
Now, I'm jumping way, way ahead now, but I want the audience to get to this, and I'm not sure we're going to get to it tonight if we don't get right to it. What is the danger if I'm in the XYZ school district, if I dump Common Core and say, well, you know, this is the way we've factored polynomials for the last 200 years. What's wrong with factoring polynomials this way right now? I throw out the Common Core and I factor the polynomials this way. What is the danger that my students can't get into Missouri State University now?
The problem is there is an evaluation rubric or process for districts.
Right.
And I believe it's 30%, maybe it's 20, it's between 20 and 30% of the evaluation of the district is dependent on the scores the students receive on the Common Core assessment. So
mm-hmm.
if you haven't taught, again, this is how everybody conforms. It's by making the test score the basically the signature of what you do. And so if you don't teach your students according to the standardized procedure, then your test scores will go down as a group, as a district, and that means your district score will go down in the evaluation process known as the Missouri School Improvement Program. And if that goes down, then you're threatened with the state coming in and you losing your accreditation and them taking over. So everybody gets in line to please that. Now, that violates another statute that currently exists that says the assessment plan of the state has to be flexible enough for school districts to determine when students have mastered the content for graduation. In other words, it was supposed to be flexible to allow for local control. And that is the problem with this system. Tremendous overreach from the state. And that's because of tremendous overreach from Washington, D.C.
But now, can't the state say that there's no connection between the Common Core annual evaluation and graduation? If you in the XYZ school district want to let kids graduate who factor polynomials the 100-year-old way, who are we to say they can't graduate from high school and get a diploma? But because they don't factor polynomials the 2015 way, you still are going to lose all your money and we're coming down and taking over your school.
That's it.
Yeah. Now, give me a nutshell feel then for how 1490 helps me in the XYZ school district if I want my kids to factor polynomials grandpa's way.
Well, what you have are parents and teachers who have applied to their senators, their state representatives, and elected officials such as Lieutenant Governor Peter Kinder. And these people, and the governor has some people he can choose, and then teacher organizations, professional organizations draw up a list of people they would like to recommend for these work groups.
Uh-huh.
Those organizations send the list to the state board because
right.
you have to have a government enter these, right, execute this process. So the point is that as a parent, as somebody who is concerned about education, you have an opportunity first to know that you're to apply to be on these work groups. So you can contact your state rep, contact your senators, ask for the form to apply. Right now, I believe the Speaker of the House has selected his participants already, but Senator Dempsey, the Senate pro tem, has not. So probably the senator would be your best vehicle for if you would like to participate. Then, after these work groups are constituted and the process of writing Missouri's own standards is completed, it's still just a draft. Then what happens in the law is the state board has to conduct public hearings on the draft. And so the public can go to these hearings and make comment. They have to be posted so that the public can view them. And the state board has to consider all comments. One of the, you might say, notorious features of the Common Core state standards is that although they say they were put out for a review process, in a press release from the National Governors Association, it says that the original work groups have carte blanche. They can ignore
right.
all of your comments as they choose.
Right.
In this case, the law says, the state board has to consider all of the comments. So as much as we had to give some ground for what we really wanted in eliminating Common Core, we maintained opportunity for public input and local control. And so at least in those two ways, applying for the work groups and then attending the public hearings, you can have a voice. You can also continue to have a voice with your state rep and your senator throughout the legislative session and let it be known to them that if there's any unsavory activity that's observed, that you will continue to tell your elected officials that they are on the line. They work for you, and their, you might say, political ambitions, if they intend to be reelected, are on the line if they do not respond to you. It is what we're up against is corporate money and lobbying organizations like the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, who's paid by Bill Gates to promote these standards. And they'll deny that, but they get huge amounts of operating money. And some of the money over the last 3 years has been earmarked specifically to promote Common Core. So when you have these millions of dollars that's coming into your state to set up Common Core and promote it, you wonder, so what power do I have? The answer is the vote. Bill Gates doesn't vote in Missouri. Thomas B. Fordham employees don't vote in Missouri. You do. So what it means is you can't be an armchair observer. You can't just sit back, listen to these radio shows and say, oh my. You must pick up the phone and learn, you know, the names of your elected officials, receptionists in the office, their legislative assistants, and tell them that you're going to be a visitor. And that you have a specific desire to have your children continue in what the Missouri Constitution says is the purpose of public education. And that is not a job, but the protection of the rights and liberties of the people. That's in our Constitution. So Common Core, because it's set up for workforce development, is actually in violation of our Missouri's Constitution in terms of why it says public education is made available. You hold your elected officials to that. You tell them, I know what the Constitution says. It's what I expect for my children. You support this, the constitutional rationale for a public education, or you're out of here. That's the bottom line.
Doctor, what's in it for Bill Gates?
A lot. I've seen estimates of the amount of money Microsoft can make by investing up front in the development and the promotion of these standards. I mean, although he's put billions into it, Microsoft is the software company that does the processing of the data from your child's keyboard in the classroom through the data warehousing,
right,
that's going to go on.
Mike Slack, take it with Dr. Byrne.
Well, I was just thinking of the old line from Jerry Maguire, follow the money, when you said Microsoft controlled the software. I noticed the preppers of Patriots Expo, you had a lot of Microsoft and Bill Gates information at your table. And was curious about that. I also noticed you had an awful lot of folks around you a great deal of the time, and I heard good things about your talk. What were people asking at your talk there?
What they were asking about, I think what shocked them most is to know that this is not just an Obama agenda, and this is not a recent agenda, although we can easily tie this back to the 1990s, with outcome-based education and school-to-work education. The history of writing standards for education goes back into the 1920s. John Dewey was the first proponent of that. And what is significant about Common Core is what I call Common Core speak. When you think of standards, you just think of a goal that you set that is lofty and excellent and that all children should be able to reach. But that's not the meaning of this standard. What these standards mean is a level of performance that everybody will meet, not excellence. The word rigor is actually given a different definition than what comes to mind when you think of excellence. Rigor actually means something like exercise very hard. It doesn't mean exercise at a level that's going to challenge your uppermost abilities. And you can see that in the math standards. Because what is going on is that there isn't enough Algebra 2 to actually teach physics in science. So next generation science standards don't have physics. And when you don't have enough Algebra 2 to take pre-calculus or trig, that means the American students who go through this Common Core Certificate program aren't going to have enough math to apply for college programs that expect pre-calculus or trig for those mathematics-demanding programs in college. And what happened in 2008 already was 56 mathematicians writing our Missouri Department of Education saying, please don't use the National Council for Teachers of Mathematics standards. They do not prepare students for the math in college. What do those standards do? They teach constructivist math, the very same math you're getting in Common Core, because it is the National Council for Teachers of Mathematics who sat on the Common Core work groups. It's the same thing. We're not getting an improvement. We're getting more of the same, and we're institutionalizing it at a national level.
I talked to a high school teacher who had returned from what he called a Common Core indoctrination recently.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he actually scared a lot of folks at our group. When he was speaking, he said the math standards now concentrated on the process. The answer was irrelevant, whether or not the answer was correct.
Yeah. Yes, and that's not a new idea either. That came from William Glasser, who was writing in the 1960s, you know, who said the correct answer is not important. What is important is the process. And when you look at the history of what they're saying now, and you know it goes back decades, then you have to understand that we got here over a long period of time. One piece of legislation isn't going to change that. And we're going to have to be vigilant the rest of our lives because there are progressive elements who know that if you're going to transition this country into something other than what our Constitution says, then you do it through the education system. They figured that out a long time ago. They've been working on it for decades. And as parents, maybe now we're getting that kick in the gut that says, I'll wake up. But then you must stay awake. This will never go away.
Well, Karl Marx said control education, and you control the population.
That's right.
What really bothered me with this one fellow, too, was a social studies book he brought. He said it was one of two that were approved right now. I didn't know if that was in that school system or Common Core itself. But it gave about one page to World War II. I don't believe it mentioned President Roosevelt at all or Pearl Harbor, but it did concentrate on the evils of our bombing Hiroshima and Nagasaki and how women became more socially mobile during World War II with jobs and race relations during World War II, but the Nazi death counts are not mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And that, to me, that is just frightening. That's, you know, that type of thing. You know, I watch some shows like some of the late night shows occasionally with clips when they show people out on the street asking questions like, how many senators do we have? And they can't name or say 100.
Mm-hmm.
You know, folks are guessing 350, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Or name the vice president. You know, and it seems to me this is just going to lead to more dumbing down. You know.
Well, and again, that process has been in place since the 1930s. It actually started with the Carnegie Foundation funding the American Historical Association. And since that time, they have been aggressive about writing books and creating standards that don't focus on heroes that you can look up to, or on events in history that really shows the bravery and courage of our American soldiers that in many ways shape countries and cultures, but instead wanted to diminish our standing in the world and make us nothing more than another country. And I'm not diminishing other countries, but what I am saying is that there's something unique in our Constitution, that American exceptionalism is limited government in celebration of the liberty God gave us as individuals and as a people. And they want to basically erase that from memory and say, no, there's nothing exceptional. And what that does is mean that, you know, when you look at the leadership in other parts of the world, in other countries, you have to ask yourself, is that what you want, to be led by thugs, or to maintain your checks and balances of this kind of government system that is a government of the people, by the people, and for the people? If you believe the latter, then you must fight for it just like they did in the American Revolution, if you know what the American Revolution was.
Right. Exactly.
But the new standards will make people not even know what the revolution was, so how can they fight when they don't know?
By design.
Right. I don't know how old you are, Doctor, but you're not much younger than me. When we were kids, I mean, it was never, American exceptionalism was not talked about in elementary and secondary school. You know, they didn't use the term American exceptionalism, but there was an ongoing education. There was an ingraining of the fact that we, America's not only exceptional, we're superior. And in wartime as well as in peacetime, our ideology has led us to the top. Go ahead, Mike.
And Dave, when you and I were in school, we were watching the space program send Americans to the moon for the first time. So some of it didn't have to be mentioned. It was evident.
Right. That's right.
As an example, my first master's was paid for by a national defense loan. And you ask the question, why would a master's degree in special education be paid for under the term America's Defense Loan? Well, that's because if you go back to the founders and what they said about education, they said a people who wants to maintain self-government has to be an educated and enlightened people, and that an education is a better defense, a better safeguard of liberty than a standing army. And so the whole point is that what we were looking at that time was John F. Kennedy wanting to celebrate American ingenuity, American capacity for creativity, and the American spirit. And he unleashed that with NASA and the space flight. That's how we countered Sputnik. But what do we have in this president? We have somebody who dismantles NASA. So we're not blind anymore. After 6 years of what's going on under this president, we know that he's dismantling what Kennedy built up for us, which is what the founders gave us, and that is a view that a limited government would unleash human potential. What this president does is he clamps down on individual human potential by growing the government and saying, no, we're going to regulate your behavior. An entirely different...
And let's
in all
don't give,
57 states.
And let's don't give the president all the credit. We have a heavily favorable political environment on both sides of the aisle in Washington, D.C.
Yes.
for what he's trying to do. We have And here's where we have to fight, brothers and sisters, and I'm talking to the listening audience now because I know I'm preaching to the choir here in this room. But we have a state executive government, and we're fast losing the state legislative government favorable to this environment. If you want to fight for state sovereignty, brothers and sisters, you fight for it in Jefferson City. Give up on Roy Blunt. Give up on Claire McCaskill. That situation is lost until the state of Missouri gets the fortitude to stand up and say, we're taking over. You butt out. And
Common Core is a perfect example of the feds circumventing the state legislature
right.
by going through the governors to
That's
give
right.
the governor's grants that gave money directly down to the school districts. That's why our legislators knew nothing about it.
Yes.
And the money never showed up in our state budget because it remained a grant that the governor controlled.
Right. I got to take a quick break here, just very quick, Doctor, and then there's a couple more things I want to get into while I've got you here. You folks hang on. We'll be back with Dr. Byrne and Common Core.
Hey, free market capitalist Missouri business owners, show Missouri and the rest of the country what hardworking, successful entrepreneurship looks like by advertising your business on Missouri Grassroots Radio. Get your message out to liberty-loving citizens who want to support liberty-loving capitalists. Target this unique and widespread market with your business's unique and valuable products and services. Contact us at info@MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org for details.
Invested as much in public education as we should have because we've always had kind of a private notion of children. Your kid is yours and totally your responsibility. We haven't had a very collective notion of these are our children. So part of it is we have to break through our kind of private idea that kids belong to their parents or kids belong to their families and recognize that kids belong to whole communities. Once it's everybody...
Well, some people without brains do an awful lot of talking. We're back with Dr. Mary Byrne, PhD in special education, and your point person on Common Core. Dr. Byrne, I want to take just a couple of minutes here for the listeners to explode, while I've got the expert on the air, some of the fact and some of the myth. Now, if you wander around Facebook, you're going to see it all. You're going to see Common Core collects data. Common Core takes DNA from your kid when they're 2 years old and decides by the time they're three whether they're going to be a garbage collector or a nuclear physicist. Common Core does this, and Common Core teaches kids that Islam is the way to live. What is first of all with this data collection that we hear so much about and so much of the danger of? To what extent is this going on, and what is the danger of it?
All right. In 2009, when the governors applied to the U.S. Department of Education for state fiscal stabilization funds, they agreed to four assurances. So those state fiscal stabilization funds came from the American Recovery Reinvestment Act. So while the news media told us that that money was needed to keep corporations afloat, $48 billion went to governors to transform our education system. All right, and they distributed it in the form of state fiscal stabilization fund grants. When the governors applied for those that grant money, they signed on for four assurances, and two of those were, one, the adoption of common standards and their aligned assessments, and the other was the establishment of a statewide longitudinal data system.
Mm.
So the data system is related to Common Core through the document called the State Fiscal Stabilization Fund application. And both of those things, the data collection system and the Common Core, are two of the four assurances. Does that make sense?
Yes, so far.
Okay. So the statewide longitudinal data system in Missouri had actually begun before that time, before 2009, because under Carnahan was very big, the governor, Carnahan, was very big on outcome-based education and school-to-work transition. He was big on the progressive agenda for education. At the time during his administration, we had begun a data collection system that was in collaboration with the U.S. Department of Labor. So in 2009, we got additional money, the statewide longitudinal data system money, in the form of another grant, in addition to the state fiscal stabilization funds. That system is still somewhat rudimentary in that right now, our Department of Ed tells us that they're collecting about 60 of those data points. What exists, and you can find it on the Internet, is the National Education Data Model. The federal government is prohibited by law from maintaining a national database. So what they are doing through the U.S. Department of Ed is giving states money for each state to develop its own database. But then, through a series of grants, such as the Race to the Top grant, it says in the language of the announcement, the secretary will prefer those states who develop statewide longitudinal data systems in collaboration with other states or will link to other states, so that over time, when this is done, the states will so-called voluntarily link their systems together, creating a de facto national database,
right,
and the federal government gets access to it. Okay? So the data system exists. It's not fully developed yet. Not all 400 data points in the national data model are yet switched on, but the fields exist. And
okay,
those 400 data points include your religion and your voting history, all those kinds of things the federal government has no business knowing.
Wow. So basically, they will be pigeonholing children from the youngest age based on things like religion,
mm-hmm,
race, voting history, political ideology,
mm-hmm,
things like that.
When
all 400 data points are active.
Mm-hmm.
And
that sums it up. Yeah.
Where will this information come from? Will it just be voluntarily turned over by parents to the school system, or?
Well, when you go for enrollment, kindergarten,
okay,
enrollment, you file papers that give them some information. Some of that information, they want prenatal information. I mean, that's already come out. We used to think P20 meant preschool up through college. P now means prenatal. We have that on videotape from state superintendents over on the West Coast. So they're actually wanting to go into the mother's medical records to add this information to the database.
Wow. This plays so well into that Melissa Harris-Perry soundbite that we played before,
uh-huh,
at the end of the last break and that we play frequently on this show. So it's just old hat to my listeners. But really, I mean, in these people's minds, your child, even before birth, is just part of their realm.
Yeah. Now don't forget, it didn't begin with Perry. Plato actually said that children belong to the state. Okay. So
yes.
This whole
and
that's if I get nothing else, clearly articulated this evening. What I want to say is, statism versus the family, according to Judeo-Christian teaching, has been in conflict since the beginning of the story of Abraham. Statism existed before then, but when the story of Abraham comes into existence and we start talking about, so man is made in the image of God and he sanctifies the family, and the fifth commandment says honor your father and mother, not honor the state. Then
right.
you set yourself up against a culture that says, no, the state is in charge. So that whole conflict, people of faith against the world, goes centuries before us, and it will continue after us. And we can't expect a bill to take care of this problem and then us relax and go away. We are part of that human story, and we must remain vigilant if we're to remain free.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, and let's remind the listeners of what Dr. Byrne is saying in layman's terms. You know, we talk and talk and talk about Common Core, and we talk and talk and talk about the progressives as though we were talking about Democrats and Barack Obama, but Race to the Top was not a Democratic program that came out of a Republican legislature. And was in fact spearheaded by a Republican, quote unquote, education senator. What was the Bush program? What was the name of the Bush program, Doctor? No Child Left Behind was not a leftist Democrat program. So what Dr. Byrne is saying is that as a parent, or a grandparent, or a citizen, without a child who cares about the future of this country and liberty, this is your issue. As she said, you know, the war for the souls of our children and the soul of the very education system is ongoing for since the beginning of time, but in our lifetime. It is really heating up. Go ahead, Dr. Byrne.
It also addresses another question about the nature of education being public. If you believe that private education is going to solve education problems, then you have to go one step further and understand that private education means private boards that the public cannot access their meeting minutes. Okay? And that means you've lost control again. The point of public education was for the schools to be subject to public review. Once you go private, you give up, you forfeit the right of your public review, and to maintain, or in other words, to protect the goal of education to be for raising up good leaders in government, you have to have the public being the watchdog. And I think that's where we get pretty relaxed thinking, if I could just elect somebody I trust, or if I could just know that an accredited organization is going to do what they're supposed to do, I can go about my business and watch, you know, my favorite shows. It's absolutely wrong. It is always incumbent upon a free people to be watchdogs of their freedom. And there are processes in place for that. But they are public processes, and that's why we must never underestimate the wonder and the gifts of public schools. But if we let them become, if we let somebody else do our work for us, we have no right to complain.
Getting a plug,
Dr. Byrne, this new constitutional amendment coming up in November we were talking about earlier.
Oh, yeah, Amendment 3.
Yeah. Could you give an opinion on that?
First and foremost, the whole concept of tying a teacher's evaluation to somebody else's work doesn't hold up to statistical analysis. It's called value-added model. And the American Statistical Association says this is so unstable, you can't use those numbers in a legally defensible way to evaluate an adult teacher's performance. Okay, so number one, the whole concept is really not defensible. That was, I can't quite think, I remember right now who came up with the idea. It sounded good, and in the discussion I heard earlier, they were comparing, you know, an engineer's evaluation being based on the bridge. Well, the bridge is made of inert material. Children are not inert material. And so there's a fallacy in the comparison. There, you know, it's not an appropriate comparison for live human beings to be considered the same thing as car components. The second thing is that it gives up local control. Because those teachers' evaluations and the student data go to the state, it becomes the state's business to review the test data, whether it's the teacher evaluation or the children's test data. That means the entity holding the contract, which is your local school board, is basically bypassed but has all of the liability of the contract holder. So the local school board doesn't maintain full control over the evaluation procedure for which it's liable. And the problem is, you know, what I see in giving up of tenure is that if you run schools like a business, then you're always going to entertain the bottom line. You're not... The argument can't be that teachers will be paid more money, because that's not the consideration of the business. The business is, am I in the black? And so the danger is your most experienced veteran teachers will always be sacrificed because they are more costly, and you will constantly be churning the inexperienced, less expensive people fresh out of school. And the real danger in that is that there are private organizations that are cropping up, like Teach for America, more than happy to give you teachers that have had nothing more than 5 weeks of boot camp. And that's your new teacher. There's some real dangers here. But unless you see the big picture, and unless you know all of the players that are out there actually cannibalizing on your children, you're going to make bad decisions. So the first thing to do is get very well informed about what privatization means for your quality people being your child's teacher.
So let's.
And I'm
not
a union member. I don't want you to think I'm defending the unions. I'm not a union member. This is just the plain facts of how businesses run, and how that's different than an organization for the public good should be run.
So let me, you know, I mean, my background is one of physics and engineering, so I did the bridge thing. Let me get away from the bridge thing, because I take your point well that concrete and metal aren't the same thing as minds and flesh. Let me ask you why, if I am a cardiovascular surgeon who specializes in high-risk procedures, that part of whether I have a job next year should not depend on my success rate compared with the success rate of my peers in the same situation?
Now, there you said, the my peers, that would be an entirely different kind of evaluation system. To have peer review, the way tenure is given to faculty in higher ed, where peers who are in your shoes do the evaluation, The problem we have is not really with the teachers. I'm not saying that there aren't bad teachers. There are. But the problem you have is in the principals who don't get rid of them because they don't want to confront the conflict involved in documenting a teacher who is not performing well, even having to go to hearings to defend it. That tenure is not a guaranteed job. Tenure is a guarantee of due process.
Right.
Now, is that process abused? Yes. And I'm not defending those abuses. But tenure is not the guarantee of a job. And I think that's another misrepresentation of teachers, that this amendment is saying it will fix when it's actually not even addressing the real problem. And the real problem is the principals.
I've got 10 seconds to get out to you listeners here, okay? We're running over time. This show will end in about 6 seconds, but everything that we say after this will still be available on the podcast. Go back to the podcast, catch it. Good night to you folks. I'm going to carry on with Dr. Byrne here for another couple of minutes, and be sure and catch the podcast, because what we say here will continue on the podcast even though you've been cut off now. So explain to us laypersons exactly what tenure is out here in the grocery store and the supermarket and the gas station where we all work. Tenure seems to mean to us that once you're there, you're just untouchable.
Well. That's an unfortunate, I would say, inappropriate neglect of the administration. If they are not really conducting adequate evaluations of teachers and doing the documentation that's necessary to basically shepherd those people who do not belong in the classroom into their next career. There are people who choose teaching for the wrong reasons. There are people who did not get a good education in their undergraduate programs. There are different reasons for not performing well in the classroom. But the mentor who is supposed to be the discerning person is the principal. And if you don't like teaching and you exit out, you know, yourself, that's fine. But there is a problem in that bottom line, that if we don't have tenure, then we don't preserve for our children the best and teachers, allowing them to get experience. I can tell you that my first 3 years I wouldn't wish on anybody, not because I had bad kids. That wasn't it at all. It's because I was inexperienced, and I was writing new lessons every day for the first year. The second year, I would go back and look at them and say, oh, my gosh, what did I do? I was basically surviving. So I could refine them in the second year. By the third year, I had my feet wet, and I could be creative. Now, if my evaluations were dependent on the first 2 years, I wouldn't have looked very good. By the third year, I had my stride. Then by the fifth year, I was ready to mentor somebody else. I had that opportunity come up. The point is, what helped me along the way was not my students' test scores, but my own experience in growing as a teacher and going to workshops and having conversations with mentor teachers. And although I may not have had the best lesson plan, I was sincere, I was genuine, I would call parents, probably went overboard because I can tend to be that way about everything I do. So there would be areas of real strength in terms of the desire and wanting to encourage a communication with parents and a willingness to grow, but they might not have showed up on my children's test scores because my kids had disabilities.
Sure, sure.
And that is where you're going to penalize teachers for taking the most needy students, and that is the plan. Remember I told you there were four assurances? One of them is the redistribution of teacher talent, which means once you've identified these teachers as, proficient or above, then you transfer them to the classrooms with the students you've identified as the neediest, which means those teachers' scores are going to go down again. What teacher in her right mind would voluntarily put herself in a position to compromise her evaluation, and may not make it, even though she's demonstrated in one setting she's very good, but because of other factors that come into the classroom, her evaluations now are going to go down. This is no longer an upward curve. It's going to go down, and it's because of the student test scores, when there are many factors affecting those test scores. Yet you're going to penalize the teacher. Get rid of her, according to Sankfield's amendment. And there's an assumption that everything will be an upward curve, that in value-added modeling, you will always be increasing and going up, and that is not life. That is not the way it happens. So the whole premise, the whole assumption that the test model is based on and that the evaluation system would be based on is not grounded in reality.
Well, here's a reality, Dr. Byrne, that I ground my analysis in. Tens of thousands of students enter college every year who can't mm-hmm. string a paragraph together in some mm-hmm. coherent mm-hmm. fashion.
Mm-hmm.
I see hundreds of people.
For a living. I do resumes every day for people with MBAs, MSs, MAs, and PhDs who mm-hmm. also can't spell, have the worst grammar I've ever seen.
Yes.
You know, the problems are at our universities, too.
Mm-hmm.
The worst are University of Phoenix and the other proprietary schools, but even the public universities. You know, I harped on that last week.
So, Mike, let me ask you,
you want to know where they came from? We abandon what a classical education was and how you teach writing and grammar for the progressive agenda of whole language. And that began in the 30s. And then Lucy Calkins at Teachers College, where I got, two of my higher degrees, Lucy Calkins was the champion of whole language in this country. And since then, because of state legislation, we have to get state legislation to get schools to stop using it, when actually if we had not, pursued these fads and these programs that good teachers knew should never have been implemented, all of our students would be in a better place. But what you've got, these remedial programs in writing, have to do with the use of whole language since the 80s and constructivist math, which was introduced back at that time. And then when they can't perform, they graduated high school with high scores because they were functioning in the environment where that constructivist education was expected. But the constructivism was not expected in college level. And therein lies the rub. That's why they had to go to remedial classes, was to unlearn what they were taught in high school. Not because the students were unintelligent. I will say because they are uneducated. But the problem wasn't the teachers. The problem was the curriculum and the process they were forced to use.
I had to explain yesterday to a man with a master's degree possessives and plurals, and when to use the apostrophe and when not.
Yeah.
And I do that almost
every day.
Are you imagining, Mike, that he graduated from high school much more capable than he graduated? I mean, are you imagining that he went downhill on his way to the master's, that he entered college able to construct a sentence in a paragraph but somehow lost that?
I think there's failure in our language skills from first grade through graduate school.
Yeah,
right.
But you know, he had to
write papers, and they were not counting off on spelling,
they weren't counting off on incorrect use of the language. They were just wanting the gist of it, apparently.
Absolutely, and that's wrong. The whole language approach is that you just get your thoughts on the page. Don't worry about how you spell it. Don't worry about the punctuation part. Just let it flow.
That's atrocious. In the last few years, we've had Katie Couric and Dan Rather using impact as a verb, and it's changing the language. And they say impact when they mean effect.
Yeah.
And it drives me up the wall.
Yeah.
Dr. Byrne, in the final analysis, as you suggested, we've been going down this road rapidly. We've been going down this road rapidly for about three decades, or at least all of our lifetimes, and we've reached this point, and we're not going to turn it around in spite of all the questions we ask in 2 years or 3 years. Is 1409 a start? How far does it get us down the road?
It is a start. I can tell you that something hopeful, and that is that in 2008, there was, or 2007, there was a Senate bill passed that authorized a college-ready curriculum in English and mathematics. And over 400 faculty and high school teachers around the state of Missouri gathered together to write what was praised as one of the best curriculum they had ever seen. And this came from a university person who was familiar with the document. Then what happened in 2008 when the document was finished, it was shelved. And in 2009, Governor Nixon signed the agreement to adopt the Common Core State Standards. Part of 1490 is that the 2008 document has to be pulled back off the shelf and reviewed for consideration of adoption. So what I'm saying is I don't think we're as far behind the curve as the public perception might lead us to believe. There was already good work being done. It got pushed aside. And now 1490 allows us to bring it out. We also have standards that were some of the best in the country we can refer to and say, you know, and shop and put together the standards we want. One of my biggest goals is to get very good history standards back in our state that will help us celebrate who we are as Americans and as Missourians. And that doesn't mean that we push aside, you know, the negative, the dark side, but we have a balanced view of who we are and where we want to go from here. And I think we can do that.
Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Byrne. I'd like to have you back sometime in the future. I didn't get to half of what I wanted to get to tonight. So I'll try to get you back for the listeners, and next time you're here, we'll open up the floor for some of these callers that have been calling in and have been ignored. Because I wanted to make sure we got to some things. I appreciate what you do. Get in a plug for your website.
Missouri Coalition Against Common Core. That's moagainstcommoncore.com. The pleasure's been all mine. I appreciate the opportunity to be on the show, and I look forward to the next time.
Thank you, Dr. Byrne. I appreciate it. Good night.
Have a good night.
Good night.
Okay, Mike, that was...
Wow, Dave, that was... Hey.
Yeah.
First time I've ever gone over.
Yeah, that was good.
Did that often?
Oh, no, I haven't done that since some of the debates we had at the before the 19 or the 2012 primaries. We had quite a few shows that went over during some of those discussions, but no, I haven't been over since then, but I couldn't let that go just because we ran out of time, and I hope the listeners will will go back and pick up the podcast, because the podcast does keep running even after the live program has ended. So I hope
let me,
you folks...
Let me introduce you to one of our callers here, Dave. Susan?
Oh, I'm sure.
Are you there?
I'm here, yes.
Yeah, Susan,
I'm here.
Dave.
Hi,
Susan,
yes. How are you?
She is a...
My
she's
question
a valid
was earlier...
I'm
against Common Core, but my question was, how can we have a lot of respect for our State Board of Education when they are appointed instead of elected?
Well, you know, that's an excellent question, and I think we don't have a lot of respect for them. I think we can't have a lot of respect for them. I think we should not have a lot of respect for them. We should approach any appointed bureaucracy with doubts and with suspicion. The last thing we should do, and we talked about this, Mike and I talked about this when we were talking about the Department of Transportation back when they were talking about giving them a tax increase. The last thing we should ever do, and I throw education in with in the bucket with the Department of Transportation, the last thing we should ever do is give unappropriated access to people's money to any bureaucratic organization. Every dollar they spend should be line item appropriated by the people that you and I vote for.
Yes.
It looks like the Conservation Department is getting in that category now too, and
yeah,
might need adult supervision.
My point of reference was the State School Board. A couple of years ago, I wrote a letter and I addressed them individually, each person, and I looked up their occupations, and boy, they all have money.
Yeah. Well, not only do they all have money, but, you know, constitutionally, they are supposed to be lay people.
They're
constitutionally,
not.
Yeah, constitutionally, they are not supposed to be people whose business is education. They are supposed to be lay people like you and me.
Well, one of them owns a ton of Branson.
Yeah. Yeah. They are an elitist group. They are a controlling group because they're elitist. I mean, it goes hand in hand with, you know, Bill Gates, the Koch brothers, I mean, all of them, left or right, if you've got that much money, if you've got that much power, you are an elitist. You believe that you get to control things, and that's the kind of people that we're talking about up there. I would have no objection to that being an elected board myself.
I would like that.
Yeah.
Let the state up into seven sections, and everybody gets to put one in.
What else you got for us, Susan?
That was pretty much it tonight, but I really enjoyed this program.
Thanks for calling. Good call.
Thank you.
All right, Mike, we got to wrap up for tonight. I'm way past my bedtime. I've been up since 5 o'clock.
Oh my goodness! Well, you better go.
Week, so.
Go.
So,
I always get a little hyped that it's going to be a while before I get to sleep, but I have recently discovered how to watch YouTube on my big screen TV.
Oh, well, there
and they
you
have
go.
Some full episodes of The Five with Greg Gutfeld. So I think I'll watch a nice political argument. One thing I was going to mention, too, Doug Ender will be on tomorrow night.
Doug, yes.
And what Mike was suggesting on the VA and a card, kind of like a Medicare card, and doing away with the infrastructure there right now is something that... Doug was pushing 2 years ago.
Right.
And I noticed 6 months after that, John McCain started pushing the same thing. So, you know, I like that idea.
Although John McCain pushes it in speeches but not in his votes.
That's true. That's very true.
Yeah. All right. Good night, Mike.
Yeah, you take care.
tomorrow night, Doug Inyart. We'll have a little talk about that, and we'll have a little talk about Article 5, which Doug has some feelings on. Good night, folks. Thanks for tuning in, come back tomorrow. Mike will be here. I'll be here. Doug Inyart will be here. And who else, Mike?
Dan Sexton from the John Birch Society.
Exactly. Tomorrow night, same time.
There are so many contradictions. All these messages we send keep asking, how do I get out of here? Where do I fit in? Though the world is torn and shaken, even if you're